It's another Thursday and another episode of Community Connect, broadcasting live from the 2MFM studio this afternoon with your Community Connect host, Ola. I hope today's episode of the show finds you all in good health and hope that you've all been having a fantastic and fruitful day so far. I know that with the school holidays upon us, weekdays are a little more hectic and chaotic for many people, especially mothers, many of whom have mixed feelings about the school holidays and their associated pros and cons. Of the pros, there's the potential for some morning sleep-ins, or not, if you have very young children who, like clockwork, are awake at 6 a.m. every day. There's also the advantage of having little helpers around the house to aid and assist when needed. And many mothers will probably disagree. And there's, well, really nothing else that I can think of that fits that category. On the cons, there's a very extensive list that I won't get into, as not to add salt to any open wounds. From the children's perspective, or at least most of them, the school holidays are never long enough, with the perks of being able to sleep in, especially on cold mornings, and having no homework, possibly being allowed to stay up later than usual, among other things that are too many to list right now. However, in addition to all these things I just listed, some kids not only look forward to the school holidays, they dread having to go back to school. Not because they have to wake up early, not even because they need to do homework, but because they'll need to go back to once again face the humiliation and pain of being the target of one or more bullies. An experience that can change a child's entire outlook, not just on schooling and education, but their outlook on life itself, leading them to lose confidence in themselves and lose trust in those around them. And this is just the beginning of what could be a potentially life-changing experience for them. But with the right intervention and the right approach, this bullying experience will hopefully be nothing more than a blip on their schooling and life radar. However, the process is not always so straightforward, and sometimes it requires some detective work, attentiveness, and professional know-how to get it resolved. To tell us more about child bullying, the impact it has on young children, and how it should be dealt with, Nick Digan, Senior Clinical Advisor at Headspace, the National Youth Mental Health Foundation, will join the program to share his insights and advice. On the issue of bullying, what it consists of, its indicators, its far-reaching effects, and very importantly, how it should be dealt with, I have Senior Clinical Advisor at Headspace, the National Youth Mental Health Foundation, Nick Digan, on the line with me to answer and advise. Nick, good afternoon, and thank you for giving us some of your time today.
Afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Nick, just before we embark on the subject of bullying, can you please tell us a little about Headspace and the role you have within the organisation?
Sure. So Headspace, as you mentioned in your introduction, is the National Youth Mental Health Foundation. There are 100 centres across Australia, 106 centres in metropolitan, rural and regional parts of Australia, and they are best understood as one-stop youth health shops. They provide support for mental health, physical health, drug and alcohol and work and study support. And that's a part of what Headspace does. Another part is also eHeadspace, which is online mental health support available about 20 hours a day, I believe. And also Headspace in schools, which supports schools to develop mental health initiatives for their students. So in terms of my role, I work at Headspace National, and I'm in the clinical practice team, a senior clinical advisor, and I work to support the clinical quality and effectiveness of the services of all of the Headspace services in centres, and eHeadspace and other Headspace programs.
Excellent. Now, Nick, we all know that kids don't always act in an appropriate manner with each other. Often kids will argue, yell at each other, and possibly say some hurtful things. And a few minutes later, all will be forgotten. Sometimes these will be one-off incidents, and sometimes they occur more often. At what point do these common child spats or verbal fights overstep what is considered to be just kids being kids and becomes behaviour more consistent with bullying?
It's really quite a commonly accepted and clear definition of bullying that differentiates it from someone being mean or, you know, any other kind of confusion that could arise. And one is that it's repeated behaviour by one or more people towards somebody else. Two, that there's an intention to cause fear, distress or harm. And three, that it's about some sort of power imbalance. And so when taken collectively, those three kind of sets of criteria are really quite clear in defining what bullying is and how it is different from someone being mean.
That's right. Now, whenever we think about bullying, we commonly tend to imagine schoolyard fights with yelling, pushing and shoving. But bullying can take on many different faces. Can you tell us about some of the less obvious forms of bullying and explain which is more likely to take place?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, physical bullying is the most commonly kind of imagined scenario, but actually it's not the most common form of bullying. So there are three forms. There's physical, verbal and relational. So the physical comes pretty obviously to mind, as you mentioned. The verbal can be insults and teasing or threatening others and anything other verbal that is quite easy to imagine as well. But the other one that's also really common is relational or social, and that's about excluding others, spreading rumours and this kind of stuff. So that can happen a lot online as well, but it's verbal and relational bullying that is the most common, and so it can be incredibly destructive for young people to experience any of these forms of bullying.
That's right, especially with, you know, access to the internet being something that you can do 24/7, there's really no escape from it.
No, and most of the time it's important to keep in mind that cyberbullying is most commonly an extension of real-world face-to-face bullying. So there's a very large overlap between those who use bullying behaviour and those who experience bullying behaviour, experiencing that in both the real-world and virtual environments. And so something you mentioned there about the added, I suppose, layers of difficulty that can come with cyberbullying is that you're right, there can be no reprieve. It can be experienced 24 hours a day, particularly if, you know, young people are having their phones or their devices in their bedroom next to their bed, if they're kind of woken up by notifications, if they're on these platforms, you know, late at night.
Yeah.
And also the added complexity that can come with anonymity on these sites. Bullying most commonly occurs in, you know, kind of in identified and known people, but it can also come in an anonymous format. And those two factors can really significantly increase. And so we know that for somebody who experiences real life or, you know, in real world bullying and also virtual bullying, their risks of poorer health outcomes are significantly greater. So the combination is worse than just one or other on their own.
What do we know about the incidence and demographics of bullying among school-aged children?
Among school-aged children, there are slightly varying numbers depending on the research that you have a look at. But within a 12-month period, you would be confident to work on the assumption that 25% of school-aged students are experiencing bullying in any 12-month period. And the age group of young people that are experiencing that at the highest numbers are around grade 8 and 9. But let's not also forget that bullying touches more people than just the person experiencing the bullying.
That's right.
So if that's at about 25%, there are a huge number of people that can be known in this kind of context as bystanders.
Mm.
And bystanders can also be negatively impacted by the experience of being exposed to watching bullying. They can feel helpless or powerless about how to stop it or how to intervene. They can feel at risk of or threatened by becoming a victim themselves. They can also become contributors to bullying as a bystander and be really disturbed or concerned at a later time about their role in having contributed to or perpetuated that. So it's more than just the 25% who are the victims.
Mm.
It's actually everybody that's involved in bullying. And some important recent research has identified that young people who are both the bully and the victim are the young people that are at the greatest risk of suicide and self-harm. So it's important that we don't demonise bullies, because research has identified that most bullies have experienced a traumatic event in the 5 years prior to being identified as a bully or reporting bullying behaviour in research. And most often, bullies are using this type of behaviour if they have been exposed to that type of behaviour themselves, or if they don't feel supported or connected in their lives or in their world, and if they don't feel like they've got other more appropriate mechanisms to be able to handle their distress or handle interpersonal conflicts. So demonising those who bully carries a lot of risk, partly because it may further alienate and isolate them from supports, which they may need in order to learn better ways to handle their distress. Mm. And also, as I mentioned, people that are both concurrently a victim and a perpetrator of bullying behaviour are at the greatest risk of suicide and self-harm.
At the very minimum, a child being bullied at school will develop a dislike of school and learning, which in itself can be disruptive to the child's learning and education. What other potentially far-reaching effects does bullying have on a child's well-being?
There are a huge number of impacts that can happen for somebody who's experiencing bullying. So particularly so for those who feel like they need to carry it on their own, or they don't feel like they can share it with others, or if they do, that they still feel helpless or powerless and nothing is being done about it. Mm. So that's why it's really important for us to have these conversations, and for parents, schools, community groups, services to take a really proactive approach about putting a stop to bullying, because a time-limited and isolated experience of bullying certainly can have detrimental effects, but young people can recover from that if they're really well supported. It's when it's really ongoing and it's pervasive and it impacts on a number of different parts of their lives and they feel helpless and powerless and it's not stopping, or they're not getting the help from people when they're asking for it, that's when the impacts can really compound. But regardless of the duration or the intensity or the severity of bullying, the impacts can include those that you mentioned, so school refusal, avoidance, isolation, withdrawal, depression, anxiety, you know, a post-traumatic stress response. It can really impact on the quality of sense of self or self-esteem, and these impacts can happen at the time and for years into the future. And that will be partially dependent on the nature of the response that parents, schools, community groups and services are able to work together to implement.
Absolutely. Now, one of the key factors that plays a significant role in the repeated and ongoing nature of bullying is the existence of an imbalance in power, whereby the bully usually preys on another child who appears to be weaker than they are. What does the behaviour of a bully say about their psyche and why they choose to behave in this way?
Yeah, so you're certainly right. A power imbalance is an important component, and it's potentially even a perceived power imbalance. And it might be around power in numbers, power in size or strength. It might be power because of somebody believing that they belong to a majority group who for some reason has an entitlement to power over another. So that is certainly kind of like a social construct that's a part of bullying behaviour. But as I mentioned earlier, it's important not to really demonise young people who are using bullying behaviour. Because most of the time they have experienced bullying behaviour themselves. Most of the time they have experienced a traumatic event in their lives recently. Most of the time they are not feeling good about themselves. They're disconnected from their own sense of self and self-esteem, and they don't have other really good methods of coping with distress. And we need to support them because they're at risk of their own significant poor health outcomes. The other really important thing about being careful not to demonise people who use bullying behaviour is because ultimately that's likely to perpetuate and increase their likelihood of bullying, because they will experience further social exclusion and marginalisation. So this is not at all trying to excuse or reduce or minimise that bullying behaviour, because the behaviour, it's really important that we are clear that the behaviour is unacceptable and there are clear boundaries around that, and schools, parents, community groups can work together to respond to those and manage behaviour expectations appropriately. However, we need to separate the behaviour from the person, because we need to connect with people who are using bullying behaviour in order to support them and get them access to services so that they don't continue to use bullying behaviour and they can learn better ways to respond. So It's not all on a punishment approach for bullies. Mm. It's not all on a kind of like a victim approach to support victims to better handle it and respond to it. Mm. It's not all on parents. It's not all on the young people. It's not all on schools. It's not all on the services.
Yeah.
An effective response absolutely cannot happen unless all of those players are working together collaboratively.
Yeah, it's a holistic approach rather than an individual.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, it's my belief, and one I think you'll agree with, that everyone has a role to play in preventing or putting an end to bullying, like we just said. But without knowing it's happening, this can be extremely challenging. And often children are very reluctant to tell someone that they're being bullied, maybe out of shame, perhaps out of fear that the bully will become more aggressive after being dobbed in, or even because they feel they won't be taken seriously. So in that case, what are some of the red flags that teachers and parents should be looking out for?
So you're absolutely right, and that's why it requires things like school events or flagship days where a school can talk with all of their students about their policy, about behavioural expectations, about responses and consequences, about opportunities for connection and social inclusion, and not just limiting or responding problematic behaviour, but creating opportunities for connection and thriving and all of those sorts of things, like building up wellbeing.
Yeah.
But to go to your question specifically around what can parents do to recognise the issue, look out for, so the obvious one for physical, like bumps, scratches, bruising or any of that kind of stuff, but also other more subtle cues like a young person wanting to take a different route to school or quite obviously kind of wanting to avoid a particular person or place or event or time, so avoidance or withdrawal. Maybe if they're not just feeling themselves, if they're becoming more teary, if they're a little more unpredictable in their behavioural responses, if they're coming up with out-of-character excuses about not wanting to go to a school or a particular place or event, impacts to sleep, impacts to their school performance. A teacher might just notice that all of a sudden they're not kind of keeping up with the workload when they usually might. Any changes to what that young person's version of normal might be. It might be that they're all of a sudden doing a lot more, you know, risky or antisocial behaviour. Really what we're looking out for is any deviation from what that person's normal is. And it might indicate bullying. And even if it doesn't, it is indicating that there's something else going on. And so regardless of whether it's bullying or it's something else, they're signs that it's important for loved ones, parents, friends, teachers, important family members to check in and say, is everything okay? And in that process of checking in, it's totally fine to specifically call out what you've seen that has given you cause for concern. So, you know, hey, Steve, I've noticed that, you know, you've been taking a different path to school, or you've been having a little more trouble sleeping recently, or you've been talking about not wanting to do the work in this assignment anymore. It seems a little odd for me. Can you help me understand what's going on there? Is there anything I can do to help, or is there anything I need to be aware of? That kind of conversation is important.
Absolutely. Now, I strongly believe that equally as important as identifying that a child is being bullied is identifying whether a child is participating in the bullying of others. Nick, are there any warning signs that parents or teachers need to be aware of that a child may be engaging in bullying behaviour?
So commonly people who use bullying behaviour will be a little torn. There'll be some discrepancy in the kind of their beliefs and their behaviour there. So although they might be doing it at the time, there's also likely to be a part of them that is feeling ashamed or, you know, like they're letting themselves down by doing this bullying behaviour. So that will mean that they'll be likely to be wanting to cover up or conceal any part of their behaviour. So if you're noticing that a young person is kind of really trying to keep you out of a part of their experience or brush off things when anything's looking suspicious or really protective about you knowing parts of their life, I mean, that's a really difficult one because young people around that age are naturally going through this process of individuation and distancing from parents. So I can certainly accept that that's a really hard thing to look out for, but it will be a part of what's going on for a lot of bullies. But also noticing a lot of those other signs and symptoms that I talked about earlier. So impact on sleep, impact on appetite, impact on motivation, concentration, any of that concealing stuff that I talked about. So And the reason that there's a lot of overlap between these signs and symptoms is because, as I mentioned, bullies are a lot of the time not feeling good about themselves either, and it's just that their way of handling or managing their distress is coming out in bullying behaviour rather than another form of distress management that might be isolation or withdrawal avoidance. But also those other telltale signs about, you know, imposing power on others in any other context. And even if it doesn't specifically look like bullying behaviour, those notions of physical dominance or power or putting other people down or those types of things, if they're happening, you know, it's possible and it's important to keep a lookout for whether that behaviour is really kind of stretching out over into what could be bullying behaviour. So it's certainly important to keep our lookout for it. It's certainly important to stay connected with that person to help them to understand that what they're doing is having a significant impact on other people and that you're willing to work with them to overcome their distress.
Absolutely. Now, I can imagine that it would be difficult for any parent to accept the idea that their child is being bullied, but possibly even more difficult is for a parent to accept that their child is the bully, a situation which can often be met with denial or attempts to justify their child's behaviour, fearing that if they were to confront the situation, they'd be admitting failure as a parent, and so it's ignored. Nick, how should parents of bullies respond, and what is the possible implications of parents coming to the defence of the child rather than trying to help them?
So, a lot of what you've said there I would agree with, but also important to acknowledge there are a few assumptions in there that may hold true a lot of the time, but not all of the time. That's, I suppose, why I've spent some time trying to really contextualise and nuance this conversation about the bully being kind of always the bad guy. And it's a difficult conversation to have, and it's a complex one because clearly the impact of this bullying is significant. And we talked a lot about the far-reaching impacts of bullying. However, if we just demonise the bully, it doesn't leave us in a very powerful place to have an effective and collaborative and coordinated response. So if a parent is really defensive of their child's bullying behaviour, it may be because they're working on this assumption or understanding, or they're having the experience of being really demonised. Yeah. And to be on the receiving end of that is really disempowering. It doesn't leave them in a position where they can work together or collaborate or seek solutions or have a more systemic approach rather than the individual one-to-one. So I suppose what's important there is that all of the players in this, and by players I mean, you know, schools, parents, young people, community groups and services, are having this conversation together. So it's not as black and white as good guy, bad guy, but it's more about we're all in this together and we're all responsible for coming up with systematic responses that are applied right across the community that can help to make sure that we're creating an environment where, one, bullying behaviour is less likely to happen because people feel supported and connected and have people that understand and there's a role for them and they're accepted. And two, that the boundaries about what's acceptable and not acceptable are really clear. But three, there's heaps of opportunities for people to be thriving and connected in their communities. And that four, that there is a recognition of inappropriate behaviour and there's a really clear and just and quick an effective response to those behaviours when they happen. So I'm hoping that's kind of in some way answered your question.
Yeah. Now, kids experiencing bullying can often be told to just ignore the bully and their behaviour. Is this necessarily always good advice, Nick, considering this could be taken as a sign of weakness on part of the bully and may further encourage the abuse?
So in some situations, ignoring, yes, can be an appropriate strategy because potentially what a bully might be after is that interaction, that bite back or that recognition that what they're doing is having a negative impact and there can be some reinforcement to that. So sometimes ignoring is an appropriate strategy and particularly in online environments because that's most of the time what's happening in an online environment. I might also add, sorry, as a quick side note here about the online environment, recommendations from the eSafety Commissioner include one, reporting any abuse or bullying behaviour to the platform that it happens on.
Yeah.
Two, taking screenshots, taking all of the evidence that you possibly can, collecting that of the bullying behaviour that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Three, not responding so that it's not kind of perpetuating or the person doing the bullying doesn't get that satisfaction or response of recognising an emotional toll has been had.
Yeah.
And what's really important, and I don't think very well known, is that If after 48 hours the site that you've reported the incident to has not taken down any offensive comments or any of the bullying behaviour, you can report that to the eSafety Commissioner, and you can just Google that, the Australian Government Department.
Yeah.
And that government department, their average time taken to take down bullying content that has gone through that process is 3 hours, and the percentage of bullying content that they have been able to take down over their last reporting period is 100%. So it's really important to know that there is an online network, an organisation that can significantly assist in this area.
Yeah.
But I'll go back to the question about ignoring. The problem with just ignoring as a strategy is that it places the blame for the management of the bullying behaviour on the victim. And that's not in and of itself an acceptable response to what's happening.
Absolutely. Now, Nick, obviously the response of parents and teachers plays a crucial role in discouraging bullying. But just as crucial, if not more so, is the response of friends or peers who may witness the bullying or know that it's happening. To what extent does the action or inaction of peers influence the situation?
Yeah, so earlier when I talked about bystanders, it's that the bystanders do play a significant role in any bullying interaction. And like I said, bystanders can be really negatively impacted by the experience of watching. And that can be about that this feeling of powerlessness or this feeling of risk about them being a victim into the future. So it can have a negative impact for some, but at the same time, it's important that this conversation and this education makes sure that the school community knows that bystanders can also play a role in perpetuating or encouraging or increasing bullying behaviour by, you know, these things that we hear about often happening a lot. So filming of bullying behaviour, posting online, sharing, encouraging, you know, clapping or cheering, this kind of stuff. So that's why it is important to have a much deeper and a much more ongoing conversation. So what we would like to get to in any community and right across Australia is that bystanders feel empowered, feel strong enough, and feel like they are at a school and in a system where if they are a bystander, they can stand up for the person being bullied, they can refer the incident to appropriate channels for response, that they can feel kind of in control and that the system's there to support them. So that's what we would love to get to, but also recognising that bystanders may feel really uncertain or at risk themselves and not wanting to put themselves in a position where they could be the next victim. So that relies on a coordinated and integrated system where bystanders feel like if they do something about it, not only will that impact on the future occurrence of that bullying behaviour, but also that they will be protected and safe from these experiences in the future.
That's right.
And again, that refers back to that connected, integrated approach between young people, schools, parents and health services.
Yeah. Talking about that integration, how would you rate current measures, strategies and campaigns targeting bullying and the way that things are working systematically together? Would you say they're effective or are there some places where we're still falling short?
I would say that clearly the rates of bullying suggest that we are not going well enough.
Mm-hmm.
So still, if approximately 25% of school-aged children each year are experiencing bullying behaviour, and we talked about the ripple effects being much wider than just that 25%.
And that's just the ones that are being reported. There are ones that are not being reported.
Of the technique or the method that was used to uncover the experience of bullying in that research was intended to be a broader cross-section and identify anonymously bullying. But yes, potentially it's an under-reporting.
Mm.
So clearly that suggests that not enough is being done.
Mm.
There are some terrific examples of national organisations like the Alana and Madeline Foundation and like the work that Headspace is doing, like national organisations that are really trying to lead this conversation to make sure that schools, parents, young people, teachers, they all know this information and they're armed and informed to do something about it. I might also add here that Headspace has a partnership with Beyond Blue and Early Childhood Australia to deliver the National Education Initiative, which is going into all schools right across Australia and to support those schools to develop curriculum-based end-to-end mental health promotion and mental illness prevention strategies that are integrated right into subjects across the board. So that project's only starting out this year,
mm-hmm.
and so there's still a lot of work to be done, clearly. But it is important to recognise that efforts are being made. There is certainly scope for improvement, that it's crucial for all of these people involved in bullying to continue to work really hard at it. I mean, it's certainly on politicians' radars, and it's important that we keep it in the public narrative. And thanks for having me on, because having these conversations is really important to keep making sure that communities understand the impact and the risk and understand that work is being done, but that it takes effort by everybody. So hopefully that will continue to result in an increase in funding so that, you know, these schools and community groups and sporting groups and services like Headspace and the Alana Madeline Foundation and others have the resources to be able to really appropriately tackle this, so that young people can just get on with what's important, which is learning about themselves, learning at school, being happy and connected and feeling like there's a bright future for them.
And being equipped with those skills to know how to deal with these situations, because without these subjects being spoken about, these kids often feel alone. They feel like they've done something wrong. They put the blame on themselves and feel like they got themselves into that situation and they're on their own to deal with it. So it's important to get it out there in the open, to let them know that, A, they're not alone, this does happen to other people, and secondly, that it's a socially unacceptable behaviour and nobody is going to be blaming them.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a really common concern that many young people go through, that they carry this in isolation, like by themselves, and that's a huge risk. And that speaks to the more work that we need to do in increasing education and busting stigma, so that young people feel more confident in seeking support, one, and two, when they do seek that support, they get a response that meets their needs and that's appropriate.
That's right. Now, to my last question, Nick, in the event that, you know, parents have tried to help, teachers have tried to help, or the child themselves has tried to fix the situation and failed to come out with anything fruitful, where can these children or their parents turn to for additional support or help?
So I suppose now we're working on the assumption that there have been sustained efforts of integration and like a partnership between parents, schools, young people, families, all that kind of stuff. It's also sometimes appropriate and suitable to refer these matters to the police, particularly for face-to-face bullying, and, as I mentioned earlier, to the eSafety Commissioner, who have incredible powers and who have agreement with just about every social media and internet platform you could imagine. They have takedown powers so that even if the platform says that that content doesn't breach their code of conduct, the eSafety Commissioner has overriding powers to take down any content that meets their criteria, which is a threshold that can be much different to platforms depending on their code of practice and is far more responsive to the experience of those being bullied. So if it's still happening, if people are still at risk, it's appropriate sometimes to refer to, like I said, police or eSafety Commissioner.
Okay, fantastic. Nick, having addressed this subject matter from all the angles I could possibly think of, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your valuable contribution to the program today. It was a pleasure having you on board.
Thanks very much for having me.
My pleasure. Still tuned to 92.1 FM, the Muslim Community Radio, and this Thursday episode of Community Connect. And so, with child bullying deconstructed and the expert advice given, I hope that we now all feel confident, should the need arise, to confront a bullying situation with greater insight and the right skills. But if you're a young person who is experiencing bullying in any form and feel that you need support or someone who can give you expert advice, you can call Headspace on 1800 650 890. That's 1800 650 890. There's also Lifeline 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Or the Kids Helpline on 1800 551 800. For anyone else wanting more information on bullying, you can check out these resources. Bullying No Way, and that's bullying, no way, one word, .gov.au. There's also the Office of the Children's eSafety Commissioner, and that website is esafety.gov.au. You can also check out Friendly Schools, which is friendlyschools.com.au. And for a complete resource guide on cyberbullying, go to backgroundchecks.org/cyberbullying. And in wrapping up this episode of Community Connect, I thank Nick Digan for sharing his professional insights on bullying with us, as I thank you all for tuning in. More of Community Connect is to come next week. Until then, though, I wish you all happy times in the company of 2MFM, the Muslim Community Radio. Please take care and enjoy the rest of your evening.